Like, seriously, in all seriousness.
I agree, I 100%.
Right? Yeah, there's no other option.
No.
What is dinner? At its most basic level, its sole purpose is to be fed. Not for any alternative or something instead, but there's a very primal reason for when we break bread. You see, we need it. It is sustenance. It feeds every muscle twitch. But the dinner we've become accustomed with has stipulations that we tussle with. Rules, regulations, like those potatoes, don't play with them. Chew with your mouth closed and keep your elbows off the table, man. And even the conversations we have, we wouldn't dare want to ruffle any feathers, so it's better that we muzzle our message, keep things surface level, because heaven forbid we must ask a question. Yeah, it's gotta be dinner time appropriate to be table talk. Because being vulnerable enough to take our self-imposed labels off, well, here's to good luck and over the shoulder with some table salt. But there's another dining table that we're invited to. And this one, it's not a wine and dine for two. It's an environment where the only requirement is that every diner is seated with an open-minded view so that he or she can, well, get fed. But it's not a feast for physical well-being. It's a meal designed for a spiritual soul healing. China plates stacked up to the ceiling with entrees that might not be so appealing or welcomed in other social settings. But here, at this table, there's no topic that's too unsettling. No, because at this table, there's no place for sweeping all of the rough breadcrumbs of how we really feel under the glow of the sterling silver stemware and the crisply folded linen napkins. No, this is the place where we take the mask off. In particular, this meal, it's not elegant, it's real. It's not for the dinner table.
Thanks, Chase. Now I have to be funny. Great. I will often remind my husband, who thinks he's so funny, that one of us was class comedian in high school, and it was not him. So. But then he loves reminding me that there were 80 people in our graduating class, so really not that funny. I love the topic that you guys are looking at. Actually, for John and I, when we started dating, it was a dinner table conversation with my family that introduced John and I to our first understanding that we had a very different way of looking at the world and at conflict. We weren't even engaged yet, and we both were working and going to grad school. And we decided at the end of the day, we would meet at my parents' house and have dinner, and then John and I would leave and go to a movie. And on the way to the movie theater in his little broken-down Volkswagen, he was uncharacteristically quiet. So I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm fine." Oh, I know what I mean when I say I'm fine like that. He's not fine. So I probed a little bit, and he got a little frustrated. And finally he said, "I think that was just, that fight was very awkward." I said, what fight? He said, "The fight tonight." I said, "Are you and I going to have a fight?" "No, Nancy, the fight at the dinner table, at my parents, at dinner, at their house. This is what happened." So I sat down, and my dad asked me how work was that day. I was working at a hospital at the time as an administrator, and I said work was fine, but I got out into the parking lot. I had a flat tire. I called AAA, it took them 45 minutes to get there. I towed it over to Forday and I got a new tire. And my dad said, "Forday, they're really expensive. We know Jeff at Sears, you should go to Jeff next time, go to Sears." My mom said, "Sears, I always go to Goodyear." That was the fight. And I remember sitting in that car thinking, uh-oh. We have a really different view on this. Like, it didn't even register in my mind as an awkward conversation. So I kind of let it go, didn't really know where to go with it. Fast forward a few months, we get engaged, and my husband, who's an internal processor, kept thinking about it and said, "Hey, you remember that event a few months ago?" I was like, Yeah, I remember that. See, you know, I've been thinking that that conversation at my family's dinner table never would have happened. What would have happened instead is my parents would have listened to me, and he said, first of all, I really never knew that there was anything I personally could do about a flat tire. I just figured the tire fairy came in and swooped in and took care of things. And I remember thinking, yeah, I know that's what you think happens in life, but it doesn't. But he said, if I told my parents that I did what you did, that I called the auto club and got a new tire, rather than suggesting alternate places you should have gone, my parents would have said, oh, honey, did you hear that? Did you hear what our boy did? You raise a kid and you never know, but we're just so proud of you. This goes in the Christmas newsletter. And so we had quite a laugh over that, one of our first introductions to one of the ongoing areas in our relationship that continues to cause problems, because we were willing to have a conversation that normally wouldn't happen at the dinner table. I think these conversations that you're looking at are probably some of the most important things in your life, and at your age, you get a chance to start to build that foundation to say, who will I be when we have those kinds of conversations? About 5 years ago, I was invited to be a guest speaker for one day in a class that was a semester course at Stanford Business School called Strategic Management of Nonprofits. And we were talking about the church that John and I used to be on staff at. Somebody had done a big case study on it. When the professor called me to invite me to be a part of that class, he said, of this semester course, the one where we look at Planned Parenthood and the one that we look at Willow Creek Community Church are the two most vitriolic days in this semester class. And I said, great, I'm there. That sounds wonderful. I love that kind of conversation. And I did it every year for about 5 or 6 years. And a couple of things struck me as interesting that were constant every time I came back to that class. I never brought my Bible. They would do a case analysis on the Willow Creek case study. They would do a SWOT analysis. And then at the end, they would do an interactive Q&A with me. And almost every time, one of the topics that came up in the Q&A was, listen, why do you need to evangelize? If you believe it, that's great, but there's really no need to try to go out and convince other people. Just keep it to yourself. And one of those rare times when you're sitting there thinking, I've got to answer this question in 3 seconds and I'm not quite sure what to say, where you say a little whisper prayer to God, and sometimes it feels like he shows up and sometimes it feels like he doesn't show up. And he showed up. And so I just said, let me tell you a story that I'm sure you're all familiar with. And what was fascinating was I could tell as I was telling the story that they weren't familiar with it at all. You could have heard a pin drop in the room every year I did this. And I just talked about, in a book in the Bible called Luke, chapter 14, Jesus tells a story about a rich man who wants to throw a very generous and lavish party for all of his friends. And he has his servants take a lot of time and effort to make everything just perfect. And then he sends them out to go invite all of the usual suspects. And the servants return back kind of sheepishly and say, here are the very lame excuses they gave. And when the servants tell the master what excuses were given, he gets a little frustrated. And he says, all right, then go back out and find the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame and bring them in. And then at the very end of the story, he says, the reason is so that my house will be full. And then I explained to the students that the reason Jesus told this story is he was equating the kingdom of God and what it is to follow Jesus with an amazing party at a gorgeous house. Who wouldn't want to come and share in that? And so unashamedly, I would say part of evangelism in my faith is about believing that that's true and wanting to invite other people. And then the second question that would get asked on the heels of that was, listen, we all grew up being told that politics, sex, and religion, you just don't need to talk about them. There's plenty of other things to talk about. You leave those three things off the table, and you can have great conversations. To which I said to these grad students, are you guys 85 years old? You're way too young to have that view. In fact, I think at your age, one of the best things in life is to go out for a beer or a margarita, if we prefer tequila, and discuss things that you don't agree on at all. And let it get a little energetic and passionate, let the debate flow, and then at the end of the time you're together, slap each other on the back, say, hope I see you again soon, and everything's good. Because some of the most important and interesting and stretching and growing stuff of life is these conversations that are not for the dinner table. We're looking tonight at the question, is evangelism dead? Way before any of you were born, way before any of you were even a twinkle in your parents' eye, on April 8th of 1966, I was around, won't tell you how old I was, the cover of Time magazine, they ran their first cover without a picture on it, only text words, not this kind of text, but words. Still, one of the top 20 most iconic Time magazine covers is God Dead? Question mark. And with all of the atrocities of the 21st or the 20th century, from Dachau to Hiroshima, and all the tumultuous social upheaval in the 60s and then in the 70s, this question, with an increase in pluralism in our society, made the cover of Time magazine, and it caused an enormous amount of controversy and debate and questions. Fast forward about 20 years later, and one of the people that contributed to that article said in 1985, maybe God didn't die, but maybe the wrong people have him. Yeah. Maybe that's it. One of my mentors was a business leader named Max Dupree. He just died this last year. Remarkable business leader, amazingly wise. And he used to tell me and many other people that one of the most important things to learn as a leader is to ask the right questions. When you're at work, leading a team, when you're with your friends, when you're raising a family. Because if you don't ask the right question, you will inevitably get the wrong answer. And I think it behooves us sometimes to spend a little extra time thinking about what is the right question that will drive the conversation eventually to get to the right answer. So I would say tonight that the right question isn't, is evangelism dead? But the right question is, what would evangelism look like in a postmodern, post-Christian culture like our Bay Area? What would it look like? So when John and I lived with our three kids in Chicago for 9 winters, I'm from Los Angeles, so I don't count it by years, but every one of those 7-month godforsaken seasons called winter, whatever pioneer stopped his wagon in Chicago and said, this is great, we're staying here, it's like, oh, wow, get rid of this guy. We lived in a little cul-de-sac, and when we moved to Chicago, our kids were in 4th grade, 2nd grade, and just starting kindergarten. And we lived there for 9 years. And in our little cul-de-sac, we got to know very quickly everybody that lived in the houses. There were about 6 of them. There was a young mom across the street, and we would often shovel snow at night together and call out and have a fun conversation across the cul-de-sac at night. And there was a widow there who had lost her husband, who was an electrician, who was electrocuted working on a sump pump in the basement. And then there was a family right next door to us, actually just a married couple. They were 10 years older than we were. They were school teachers and childless by choice. They were very devoted to their careers. And they were just lovely people. And they were the only ones on our cul-de-sac that we could tell did not go to church. We worked at a church. So it became our job to, over time, invite them to church. And we were friendly with them. We'd go over to dinner at their house. They'd come over and give us gardening tips, tell us which plants you could and couldn't plant because the growing season was so short. And I would tell them some Sunday, my husband's going to be preaching. We'd love to have you come to church. And they would say, oh, we'd love to, but we have a lot of papers to grade this weekend. Fair enough. Months would go by, and then I'd come up with another idea, and I'd say, hey, I'm preaching this weekend, and We'll even throw in a free lunch afterwards. And the look on their face was like a deer in the headlight, and it was something like, we'd really love to, but we're going to be clipping our fingernails on Sunday. Oh, so sorry. Maybe another time. Where it became increasingly obvious to me that they didn't mind being neighbors, but they didn't want to go to church. Now, when I was growing up in the 60s and the 70s, and even in L.A., when you invited your neighbors to go to church, 9 times out of 10, they'd say yes. So we're coming across something new now. Now, fast forward a couple of years. We had probably lived in the cul-de-sac with them 6 or 7 years at this point, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Early stage, very hopeful, ended up working out fine, but we would take meals and go and have conversation with them, and every once in a while I would run into the husband in the front yard, and he would say, give me an update on how Pat was doing, and then he would say, could you think some good thoughts for us? And I said, well, I will, but I'm not a big believer in the power of that, but I'd be glad to pray for you. You know, just a little thing, a seed. I don't know if it was goofy or not, but they weren't coming to church with us, so I didn't have a whole lot of other options. Then a few years later, he had a heart attack, mild enough, recovered well, but John went to the hospital immediately. We tried to do what Gloria said in here a couple weeks ago. Just show up. And then, about 2 years before we moved back here, 14 years ago, I was out in the front on a spring day, and I was doing something in the flower bed, and Neil, the husband, came bounding over, and I thought he was going to tell me something about the flowers because he was a genius gardener, and he said to me, hey, what time are your church services on Sunday? We'd like to go with you. I'm thinking, what? 7 years I've been asking you? Of course, I didn't say this. I said, oh, here are the times. Tell me why you're interested. He said, well, you know, we work at this school a few miles away. Both of us are teachers, and we work with a number of teachers' aides. One of them has become very dear to us over the last few years. You know, Nancy, what teachers' aides make. She's a single mom. Her husband left her a couple years ago with 3 children. She's one of the best teacher's aides we have. We love her. She works really hard to get her kids off to school, and then she has to take 2 buses to get to work with us because she doesn't have a car. And I'm thinking, I have absolutely no idea how this ties into why they want to come to church, but I'm acting very interested. And then he said, she came into work a couple of weeks ago super excited, and she said, you're never going to believe what happened, but a church I don't even go to donated a car to me, a van, if you will, all refurbished, beautifully done, with all kinds of gift cards inside for gas stations and car washes. And they kept asking her questions like they couldn't believe it. They were thinking, you know, was this a Nigerian princess? Should you be responding to this? I don't think this is good. And she went on and on, and finally they said, oh my gosh, I think that's the church that the people next to us who have been driving us crazy trying to get us to church go to. And I said, yes, that would be our CARS ministry. We have a CARS ministry. It is my favorite ministry in the church, even my favorite, and I ran 2 of the ministries at the church. And I said to Neil, do you want to know how it started? It started about 5 years ago when our senior pastor got done giving a sermon, and then he went down front to greet people, and some guy comes up who's about 6'5". You could smell the tobacco on him, had grease around his fingernails, many, many tattoos, lots of piercings, very bad teeth. And he said to Bill, I've been coming to this church for 2 years. It's changed my life. 2 years ago, I came to this church. My life had fallen apart. I was addicted to drugs, to alcohol. My wife left me with my children. I lost my job. The first Sunday I came to this church was out of sheer desperation. Somebody had told me about it. I had a gun, and Bill's like, security? Ushers? Anybody? And then he went on to tell Bill that besides listening to sermons, he had gotten involved in one of the addiction recovery groups that the church had, eventually gotten into a small group, understood who Jesus was, invited Jesus into his life, talked to his wife about it. She hesitatingly began spending a little, family got pieced back together. Addictions got put in the right place. He got job training. And then he said to our senior pastor, I am so grateful for this church, I need to do something. See, that's what happens when we get filled up with so much grace, we don't know what to do. And that really is the place that evangelism comes out of. This overflowing and this desperate need to do something because you've been given so much, you can't stand it. And he said, I can't preach a sermon, I can't sing a song, I'm a mechanic. And then, the best part of the conversation, he told our senior pastor this, when I come into the church, I notice that you have a lot of rich people going to your church. What? I know cars. I see them get out of these cars. I know what's going on. He said, you also have a lot of poor people that go to this church. And almost everyone that gets out of a bad car is a single mom. In fact, some of the cars are so bad that when I watch the moms get out of the car and take their kids in, after they're inside, I go underneath the car and scoot under to look at the engine. And Bill's thinking, you bring a gun, you're looking under cars. This is not good. And then he said, listen, I have an idea. The next time you get up and preach, why don't you tell the rich people? It's the only a mechanic that just came to faith in Christ could talk like this. Next time you get up there, why don't you tell the rich people that they don't need trade-in value on their car when they get a new car? Donate it to the church. I'll find some other guys and women like me that know how to fix cars, and we'll take it to the auction. And we'll buy four cars for the price of that one fancy car, and then we'll bring it back to the pole barn in the back of the church property, and we'll fix it up, and we'll get it ready. And then a bunch of small groups heard about it, and they wanted to donate gas cards and car wash cards. And pretty soon this ministry happened. And about the time we left the church was giving over 100 cars away a year. And our neighbors, who wouldn't come to hear us preach, who didn't care that we had a great music department, met somebody in their life that they cared greatly for, who the church showed up for in their need, who didn't even go to the church. And that path crossing became them coming to our church. And the last 18 months we were in Chicago, we got to be with them. I'll never forget the first time I got up to preach and I called the ushers forward for the offering and they had joined the offering team. I could barely compose myself to give the sermon. When we left Chicago, 2 years later, they left because they got smart and moved to Florida. Come on. And they said, can you help us find a church down in Florida? Because it's changed our lives. The Greek word evangelism just simply means the proclamation of good news. That's all it means. The proclamation of good news. And Jesus did two different methods when it came to evangelism. He preached or taught, and he served and healed. And going back and forth between preaching and healing, public and personal, telling and showing, Jesus put in front of us this model for evangelism. So I'm just going to spend the last couple of minutes going through three things that I think are really important for evangelism to be effective in a post-Christian, post-modern world where when you invite people to church as the first opportunity, they're probably going to look at you like you have six heads. The first is, and I mentioned this a few minutes ago, that when somebody is so filled up with grace and it starts to overflow, they need to know what to do with it. In Psalm chapter 16, verse 11, the poet writes about us being so filled up with God's love that we are spilling over. My son, Johnny, who was 5 years old when we moved to Chicago, when he was about 3 years old, he wanted, because he had two older sisters, he wanted to be able to pour his own cup of milk. And being the mother of a toddler, I knew, oh, this is going to be massive cleanup duty for me the first few times I teach him how to do this. So I kept putting it off. One day his sisters were both off to school. He was very adamant that it was time for him to learn how to do this. And I thought, I have nothing else to do. The mop's right here. I got paper towels. I can handle this. Let's do it. So I sit him up on the kitchen cupboard. And he takes the cup, and I hold it down there tightly. He takes the jug of milk, turns it upside down, straight upside down, and then smart enough just to stop it at just the right minute, was totally crowning. And then I think, okay, we did it. I'm going to have him lean over and sip it, but he doesn't want to sip it. He crawls off the counter and grabs the cup and swings it over onto the table. Not a trick question. What do you think happened to all the concave milk? Convex, concave, convex. Yeah, everywhere. Now, lest you think I was the kind of mom that got deep spiritual lessons out of my children on a regular basis, that just did not happen. But in this moment, it did. And I remember thinking, I think that's the picture of how good work and evangelism and all the ways of loving and being kind with people comes out, that there's something, number one, between me and Jesus that has to be in the right place for me to do evangelism. You've heard this analogy so many times, it's so hackneyed, I'm embarrassed to say it, but it's the reason they tell you on an airline to use the oxygen mask first and then help somebody else. If you use that oxygen mask and you need it, you're going to share it because you're sharing good news. Not because you want their opinion on the oxygen, but because it is saving your life. Because you really understand the gospel yourself. You really understand that apart from God, whatever road you go down, whether it's riches or success or sex or whatever it is, at least according to the Bible, a cul-de-sac. And that it will start off being a great road and eventually it will be a dead end. The book of Ecclesiastes, that's what the whole book is about. Try all of these roads, the author says. Try them. And you will find that they're dead ends. So something has to be happening. The good news has to be good news to you if you want to share it. Spurgeon, who was a preacher many centuries ago, said that all evangelism is one beggar telling another beggar where to get bread. When the gospel becomes bread and air to you, there will be a natural outpouring of it that's really important. The second thing is that you need community to do it well. In Acts chapter 2, that beautiful passage of how the early church got started, starting with verse 42, going to verse 47, it talks about they lived together, they broke bread together, they ate together, they gave away what they needed so that nobody was without whatever they needed. And then it said God added to their number daily those who were being saved. Something happens when you live in community with other people that allows evangelism to happen. Years ago, when we still lived in LA, I was a nurse for a number of years. And one of my last jobs, I did med-surg nursing for a while, then I was an emergency room nurse. Then I did home health. And home health was very interesting because whether you were in a rich neighborhood or a poor neighborhood, behind the doors of every house was untold suffering. Horrible cases that we had to take care of. And I remember one family in Baldwin Park. I pulled my car up. I read the chart before I went in. I knew that it was a Hispanic family that spoke very little English. They had a 5-year-old boy and a 3-year-old boy, and the 5-year-old boy had adrenoleukodystrophy, which is sort of like an ALS in children. And it starts by the time they're 3 or 4, and it robs them of everything that they have, and then they die. And when I walked into the very bare house, the little 5-year-old was in a diaper, skeletal on the couch with a towel underneath him and a feeding tube in. And he was blind and he was deaf and it was awful. And the little 3-year-old was playing trucks on the car and the mom sat down at the kitchen table and with my very broken Spanish and her very broken English, I tried to get information from her to understand the case so that we could give care for her. And I had to ask her a question about medicine and I opened the kitchen cupboards. Was hardly anything in them. And then I asked her where her husband was, and she very sheepishly said, "He's not here." And I thought that meant he was at work, but upon further questioning, she was clear that he had left her 2 weeks ago. Left you? They had only been up from Mexico for a few years, so they didn't have much of a support system. And she said, "Yes, he left me when we went to the doctors for the last doctor appointment." What happened? The doctor told them that this little boy, this 5-year-old boy, was about 3 months away from them needing to scoop him up and put him in a coffin and bury him, and the testing on the 3-year-old had come back and he had the same disease. And when she took her 5-year-old son off to bury him, she would very soon put that towel down again and pick that little boy up and put him on the couch, and it was more than the husband could stand, and he left, and she stayed. And I went out to my car and wept. And then I did what every good activist does. I got a piece of paper out, and I started feverishly writing. I'm going to get my small group to donate food. We're going to go grocery shopping. I'm going to find babysitting care for this woman. I'm going to talk to doctors that I know. I made a list of about 20 different things because I was going to show up. You know what the very first thing I did was? Sometimes when I tell this story, somebody will yell out, pray. Like, oh, no. I did absolutely nothing. I meant to. I had great intentions. I had a list. I was more moved than I had been, I think, in my whole life. But life got busy, and the list made it from my lap over to the passenger seat, and then one day I was getting the kids in, and I had to put it in the back to get the car seat in, and I think probably eventually a month later I went to the car wash, and I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. And I can pretty much guarantee you if I had taken that list to my small group, I would have activated something beyond what I could have even controlled. I believe that. I got busy. I got guilty. But when you're in community and you have other people that say, oh, I want to help. I want to do this too. You see a power that gets released like happened in the early church in Acts chapter 2. And one of the most amazing things that I love about what this community is doing is your commitment to Generations United. Tutor those kids. Third grade reading levels are highly predictive of educational success. Habitat for Humanity, building homes, feeding the homeless on Friday mornings. Great, great work. You need you and Jesus so that you're filled up. You need a community that will activate each of you to keep going when it gets hard or when you forget or when you feel guilty. And the last thing, you need to have conversations about things that are really hard. I needed to be able to tell people that I did nothing. It's taken me years to be able to say that in front of people. You need to have conversations when you see things that are too horrific to even name and then to realize that God has called you to be a part of what it means to show up. Because you can't ever have evangelistic conversations if you haven't shown up. And showing up will take sacrifice. But I can guarantee you that almost always the sacrifice will be so worth it the next time it will feel a little less like sacrifice. And when over at the school in Redwood City with Generations United, that little kid comes running up to you because he remembers your name, because he remembers you read to him last week, or the teacher tells you the little girl you held on your lap last week and read a story to is doing much better in school in her reading. That is a seed for the gospel. That is the disproportionate impact of small things that Jesus said is at the heart of the definition of evangelism. Good news for you, for me, for the world. God, sometimes it's easy to forget this good news that we've grown so accustomed to, we take it for granted. I think our entire lives are being shaken and reminded with prophetic words, with joy, with wonder, with gratitude, with all of the things that remind us that we are the recipients of a grace that we cannot even describe, that we cannot put into words. So help us to show up. Help us to fill up with Jesus. Help us to be deep in community, to encourage each other and to stimulate to good deeds each other. Help us to have the conversations. Help the good news to go beyond our small little lives into your big and beautiful and broken world. And most of all, we ask these things not only in the name of Jesus, but because we are so thankful for him. Remind us of that multiple times a day. Amen.